You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, this is the Brian Callen Show. What do you call your show?
Fitzdog Radio.
Fitzdog Radio.
It was a mistake. It's a little
close. It's a lot better than The Brian Callen Show. It just sounds so hacky. And Rogan was like, you got to call it The Brian Callen Show. Anyway.
I was thinking about it today, actually, because, you know, in the end, you're like, WTF was really kind of smart. Because it's got some attitude, and it's short, and it's like, you really brand the WTF thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got Adam Carolla Show, and you think, well, that's good, because you're literally, your name. You're Adam Carolla. You go on the road, you do stand-up, you do whatever. It's all one thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's weird that I actually get recognized sometimes off my podcast in places like, you know, Missouri, or wherever it might be, or Portland. Be like, you Brian Callen? I'm like, yeah.
From your voice?
And I figure they're going to know me from something. They go, I listen to your podcast instead of like The Hangover or something. And
well,
you know.
You know what it is also is I believe that there's three levels of people coming up to you on the street. Now, you've had experience in film, TV, and podcasting.
Yeah.
When they see you on a big screen, you're way bigger than they are. So when they come up to you on the street, they don't really approach you. TV, they'll tentatively walk up. Podcast, they put their sweaty arm around you and
yes.
start asking you questions about your kid.
Yeah, that's so true, huh? There's more
right.
of an approachability.
Right.
You're just a voice. You're not a celebrity. You're somebody that's in their car.
In their head. They got on headphones.
Yeah.
You're whispering in their ear.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very working class because a lot of people that listen are at cubicles.
Or in their trucks.
Right.
Or it working in some job that they'd rather not be in, like a toll booth.
Well, if they, and this isn't to insult the listeners, but
not
if they
all.
Had an important job, they wouldn't be listening to a podcast.
Right. I mean, that's why actually podcasting is important. I mean, and I appreciate that because I've had those kind of jobs. Part of the reason I became an actor and a comic is I just wasn't good at anything else. I just couldn't work
right.
in a regular job.
Yeah.
I was going to go crazy.
Yeah. I never had a job.
Yeah, I have. I sold Time Life books.
Really?
I worked construction. I worked at McDonald's. I was a camp counselor.
I mean, no, I had teenage jobs, but I went to college and I started doing stand-up in college.
Wow, not me.
And I was lucky enough when I graduated that there was a comedy explosion in Boston, and any asshole with
yeah.
a car in 10 minutes could make $500 a week in
cash. You're legitimately funny, too.
But, I mean, well, thank
you. You are. I mean, you're a real comic, but I was in... I worked at Lehman Brothers for 2 years.
Oh, that's right. Your family's in the banking world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Was that a hookup from
no.
family connection?
No. In fact, my dad said, you're not going to get a job, you know, because I was such a smartass. He goes,
right.
you're going to look at things in a year from now and just know that chances are you're going to be without a job, and I think it's going to be very humbling and important for you.
Humbling in the sense that he wasn't going to bail you out.
I got every job offer I went in on because I bullshit my way through.
Right. You have confidence that is, it's not overwhelming. You're an alpha male, but you're not smothering with it. You because you're a listener and an actor, so I think you're able to.
I never think of myself
let
as an alpha
people
male.
In.
I've heard other people say that. I actually look at it as more the fact that I like people,
right?
And that I am very, very attuned to. I think two things: one, what people are guarded about. What they feel a little insecure about, and then what they are proud of. And I had to learn that very quickly as a young kid because I was always thrown into new circumstances.
Right.
So I'm able to, and because I like people, I protect the part that they're guarded at.
What am I guarding?
I don't know. I mean, we could go into it.
Yeah, let's go into it.
I think as a comic, you're not somebody who is, you're not somebody who I see. You look very healthy to me as a mm-hmm. person. I think that there's a lot of Catholic Irish tradition.
Ding ding
yeah,
ding.
That is very anchoring for you. But it's also because you are a guy with an imagination and an artist and somebody who is ambitious in your own way, but in a healthy way. That's something you've always had to contend with. You know, when you're Irish, when you're of your background. There's a great deal of emphasis on being a spectator and not a participant. This is not for you.
You are humbled by your family. If
yes.
you ever try to present yourself as special or they immediately go, oh, look at you. Oh, Mr.
James Joyce left Dublin because of that. I mean, right. there was no way for him to be a real writer or anything. Right. I mean, that's kind of part of what he...
Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It was all about a guy getting beat down.
Yeah. I mean, look at what he went through in school where the priest said was describing in horrifying detail what hell was really like. That priest was clearly a sadist, by the
way. Right.
But that is, I mean, in Leon Uris's book, Trinity, with the Irish, I mean, the family is broken apart. The hero of that book, Connor Larkin, because his wife confesses to the priest that she enjoys sex with her husband.
Right.
Huge sin.
Right.
That is a perversion of, it was anti-nature. Anything carnal, anything of the flesh, and we are physical beings, you know, was considered... sinful.
Well, the virgin birth is an admission that Christ could not have come from something as filthy as sex.
There you go.
It had to be the Immaculate Conception.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I disagree with all that because, you know, Aristotle in rebuttal to Socrates said, look, man, we're also physical beings, man. Yes, yes, the idea is to aspire to let go of this body because ultimately you're going to die and prepare your soul for the next life, blah, blah, blah. But you watch a woman through childbirth or somebody go through a war wound on a battlefield screaming for his mother. That's real, man. That's right. Real. So if you're going to suggest we're not biological machines that feel, miss a meal and 4 hours of sleep and tell me how you're doing.
Well, that's what they said about, I think it was World War II, where they talked about soldiers that were, you know, going down in what they thought was going to be their death on a plane or a boat.
Yeah.
That guys with all the religion in the world and all the crosses and all the faith, they all cried out for their mothers.
Well, that's always been what I've never been to war, so I don't want to speak this way for anybody who has. But
well, you've been through pilot season a number of times.
Yeah. No, but it's they I know in Europe that was always the tradition when you know in Italy they there's an expression and I don't know what it is, but my friend told me you always scream for your mother. You know.
Right.
I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if I would do that, but you know, it sounds like fodder for a good writer.
Well, it is the ultimate home base. I mean, you are born of that person physically. You wean on that breast.
Yeah.
The eye contact that a mother makes with her child while they're small is the light. It is literally physically the lifeline. So there's something as abusive and as distant or whatever your mother might be. It still is in your DNA that's the safest place in the world.
I've come to appreciate my mother so much as I got older because my mother's so devoted to me.
Yeah.
I never had to worry about anything. My mother
still is. Do you have one brother?
I got a sister.
Yeah.
But my mother is so devoted to me. You know, she was so devoted to her children. She took on... I have a great deal of respect for women as I get older, as I watch what, like, my wife does with her children. And when I watch
with her children,
yes, with my children,
right.
You know, and when I watch
you said her children,
well, you know, I they're such a separate entity sometimes when they're right. together, it's like this love affair where there's this
right,
but the devotion, the biological devotion, and my mother the same way, you know, I think that really gives you, you know, you said I was confident. I think a lot of that confident or grounding came from the fact that I knew my mother, and by the way, my father as well, were, devoted to me, that loved me, that in fact I came first before them.
Do you think you came before your dad's career? Because he's very successful,
I do. In many ways, I do. I never thought about that. And the reason I never had to think about it or thought about it is that even though my father was gone a lot when I was growing up, he was traveling, I always knew I mattered. Right. I always knew the guy lost sleep over the fact that I wasn't doing well in school.
Right.
The fact that my mother had to literally change my fucking report card. She would stencil my report card because my father would flip out if I didn't have at least some
B's. Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, so she had your back.
She had my back.
On a deep level.
She had my back. She had my father's back. She was helping both of us.
It sounds like that is the basis of something because that you really do feel special.
Yeah, I think, you know, my mother one time said, somebody said, when I was doing Mad TV and I was in Wisconsin, and somebody said, well, you know, your son's famous now, because everybody, it was right when Mad TV was out, and people were recognizing me for the first time. It was kind of crazy. My mother said, he's always acted famous. She said, that's it, believe me,
right.
it's nothing new for him. Right. He's always walked around like he was a celebrity.
Well, that's interesting, because, you know, that my friend, You remember Stand Up New York? There was a guy, Scott Krantz, who used to run the room.
Yeah, I like Scott.
Well, he started out, and he was a bartender with Bruce Willis. And he said that Bruce Willis would go out for an audition. This is when the auditions were back page casting, you know, like just fucking cattle drives.
Yep.
And he would go in, and Scott would say, how did it go? And he would go, I didn't get it. They're fucking idiots. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, he believed from the beginning that he was a star, and it was just a matter of time until life came around.
And you know, speaking of being Irish, that's very anti-Irish for the most part.
Right, right.
You're not that guy. You're the spectator. Don't stand out. So much of it is battling against your culture, against what is expected of you and what you're told you are.
Well, I really think, because I look around, I look at Rogan, who I started with, and I look at Maron, who I came up with, and Lou, all these guys, and like, I know I'm funny. I don't know if I'm like, what is a star? I know I'm not one, and I've been doing it for 25 years. And you really stop sometimes. You go, what is it that really held me back? And I think that you said it when I said, what is my thing I guard? It's that I don't feel that I deserve to go to that next level.
But by the way, it's what makes you a lovely fucking guy. I mean, I'm sorry, but I would rather hang with a guy like you sometimes than a lot of people that have the other thing.
Right.
Because there's not a whole lot of room. Because what you also have is consideration.
As I showed up 15 minutes late for your podcast.
Well, whatever. I mean, you genuinely laugh at people. Like, if I tell a joke or something, you really laugh at it because you're really listening and connected.
Right.
So, in a lot of ways, it's what makes you a great father and a great husband. You put other people's happiness in many ways before your own. Or at least
that's
not
nice
or,
to hear. That's a nice perspective. That makes me feel better.
But it's true.
I guess that's a very
masculine expression, by the way. You're talking about alpha males. I'm writing about this now. The alpha male prototype is the idea of a guy who comes in and bulldozes his way through with the big muscles and the guns, or he can fight anybody in a room, whatever it might be, and bang all the girls. Oh, that's great. That's great. Till you're a father, till you're a husband, until you're a guy that other people depend on, until you're a doctor and you have to make people feel better, until you're a leader, in fact, and you've got to figure out a way to get people on your frequency and show them a better way to live, until you're trying to win the day with a better idea and trying to defeat a bad idea.
Right.
I don't think that the founding fathers who sat in that room in July were all alpha males. And if they were, then I can promise you that they all took a back seat with that bullshit, because there was no room for somebody to win. There was only room for cooperation and solving a political problem.
As a matter of fact, I'm reading a book right now, or I should say I'm listening to a book, because I only ingest literature through my ears at this point. I go to bed and I listen to it. So, of course, audible.com. Can I plug your
I love it, dude. I use it.
Are they a sponsor for you?
They have been in the past, but I think they're great.
I will tell people to go to audible.com and then put in offer code Brian. But I'm listening to this book right now, and it's called, what is this called?
That is called Founding Brothers, which by Joseph Ellis, which I have read.
You have?
Yes.
Oh, it's about, exactly, they were not alpha males.
Great book.
This is John Adams and wait, who are the guys? There's six guys, and basically
Jefferson, Adams, there's John Adams, there's Thomas Jefferson, there's Ben Franklin, but he kind of like presided over things for the most part. There was James Madison.
The guy who developed money.
James Madison, there was John Jay.
Hamilton.
John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, who was very, very instrumental. And, you know,
he was the money guy.
He was kind of also, I think Hamilton was the guy who did most of the writing of the Constitution. I think it was him or Madison. Anyway, I don't know. I got to look at it. But,
and John Hancock. He was on the bench, but he was the guy that did a lot of the drafting also. But I think essentially what you're looking at with those guys is they had to be collaborators, because the idea of a strong federal government was the antithesis of everything we had fought for in the Revolutionary War.
Right.
They wanted states' rights.
There was no room for a king in that room.
Right.
And the reason there was no room for a king is that a federation, the Federalist Papers, the idea was that this was rule by the people, for the people, of the people. That it was a consensus. There was a wisdom to a crowd.
Right.
You know, there's this philosopher, philosophy professor, Dan Robinson, I've had on the podcast, who was taught at Oxford and at Georgetown, a brilliant guy. And he said, the founding fathers solved the political problem. No one else was able to do it, not the Greeks, no one. They solved it. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is something that is that you don't argue with.
Right.
Nobody does. Every country in the world essentially tries to reach for that ideal.
They say that other than ancient Greece, and it was like, ironically, like part of like Bosnia at one point, there has never been a representative government that was basically capitalist, that other than us, that was stable and lasted.
And a lot of it was an offshoot of the British contention that the British problem, the Parliament and the King, the issue was, to what extent did the King have sway over the landed gentry, the aristocracy, Parliament in general? And that was where the debate started.
Right.
How much power does the King have? And who governs the King? Who governs there was the great chain of being. It was really God, and then there was the King, and then there was the aristocracy and the landed gentry, and then the serfs, and it just went all the way down. And you didn't really aspire out of your class.
Right.
I mean, part of the reason
Parliament fit into that?
It was an amalgamation of, I believe Parliament was essentially the aristocracy. It was essentially an oligarchy that was always in
so they weren't voted in
contest
by the
with the King, you know.
The King appointed them?
Yes, I believe so. And you were kind of born into being a duke.
Right.
You were appointed these things. You were a duke, you were an earl. But you didn't have a large group of people on the bottom that aspired out of their class. In England, even to this day, in Great Britain, your accent gives you away.
Right.
When you walk into a room, your accent, although it's changing a little bit now. In fact, I just had a linguist on my podcast who said that there's this when you're of higher class in England, you still talk like this. You've got this Muckney. Mm-hmm. You talk like, all right, mate, you're right. You know, they do all this stuff where it's like they're not working class, but it's a little bit shameful to be really wealthy and not having had to work for it.
Right.
So kids obviously go, I want to.
There's a backlash to what had traditionally been, you know, all about breeding.
Very much so.
Wow.
But by the way, that's still very resilient. We don't have that in this country. The biggest thing, George Will was talking about, the biggest advantage our country has is the fact that people are not jealous of somebody who's in a higher class in this country because they believe they have the potential to get there.
That's why we vote against tax increases for the wealthy.
There you go.
Because everyone believes that they are potentially a wealthy person.
They think
they're going to hit the lottery.
Yeah.
They believe that. And the whole idea of like even the small, the way we vote for the farm bills, it's like people really believe there's ma and pa farms that are going to get big and they need the right to develop. It's all fucking agro. It's big agro.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what happens, remember, is there becomes a cottage industry grows around every law you pass in government. You pass a law in government, in 5 minutes, there's a cottage industry that doesn't want that law to go away because they're making money off it.
Right, right.
You got to be very careful of that.
Yeah, and so, but getting back to you, what is the, I'm trying to think, you want me to guess what you guard against?
Sure.
Well, I know your core is good. What kind of core work are you doing these days?
My core, I'm boxing.
Okay.
Tennis.
Right.
And then I lift weights.
Got it. We belong to the same gym, by the way.
Yeah, I don't go there as much. I don't have time.
Right.
But I like to box because it shows me how tough I'm not. It's a new thing for me. I like fighting.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous that I'm just still trying to be the guy I'm not. And then
do you try to rip
tennis.
The upper abs or do
no,
you try
I
to
never
focus
care
on
about
the sides?
That. No. I don't care about as I'm not cosmetic that way. If I was
but
cosmetic,
I've seen you in the gym, and you do a thing with Lou, your trainer, where you guys do like a 25-minute workout.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
Where you just, it's like boot camp.
Yeah, because I want functional strength. I don't give a shit about, if I really cared about physical, like how I looked, I'd be taking some steroids and I'd be bodybuilding. And I'd be eating in a crazy amount. My interest is just in health, being elastic and being on stage and being able to do 2 hours of comedy, and I just want to feel good and be feel strong. And to be honest with you, I just want to be ready in case the shit hits the fan.
That's the thing I would think with you guard against is I feel like there's like there's a vigilance against life.
Yeah.
I feel like you have this fear that something's going to happen and you need to be ready to deal with it.
Always.
Whether it's on stage with a heckler or whether it's walking down the street physically being like
always,
you're
brother.
A protector
I'm
of
ready,
your
I'm
family.
Ready, I'm ready to go to jail.
You ready to fight me right now?
I'm ready to take you down.
Let's do it.
I'm literally ready for jail. Like I'm ready. I hate feeling vulnerable. I don't want to eat shit. I don't want to be the guy that trade for cigarettes. I want to be the guy who says, "Look, bro, I'm 170 pounds, and you can probably take me out, but I'm gonna figure out a way to make myself violently useful to another group."
And you'll be the one guy that crosses over. You can have lunch with the black guys one day, the supremacists the next day.
I would hope so.
You'll be the guy that mingles. You'll be the only guy in jail.
The only way you did is you stay very neutral, which I would have to. I'm not. They're not using the medium white guy who's the sometimes working actor as their assassin. And I'm
no,
very
you're
aware
doing warm up. You go over and you work the picnic benches with the Latinos. You do some comedy. You know the different styles. You know with the black guys, you're gonna go big.
Gotta
you know
it.
What up with the one sock in the laundry? The sock be like. And then the next day, you're doing more observational stuff for the white guys.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
You ever notice when?
I've actually fantasized about being that guy, just being the courtyard fool. Hey, fool, come over here, man.
Right.
We're bored. We need to laugh. We just had a stabbing.
Right, and they need
sure,
you.
Sure, guys.
Because it's so bleak in there.
What's
and
the deal
you
with
could...
all these shanks? Hope you guys are disinfecting them. Can anybody say tetanus?
Yeah. Hey, Rodriguez, nice shank. You still got that from your gardening days?
Ah,
it's good. God, if we go in together, we'll do a traveling. It's ridiculous. Intellectually, you can know something's ridiculous, and yet you can't stop doing it. That's my problem.
Right.
That's my problem.
Well, what are you saying? What does that tie into what we're
I
saying?
I think it's held me back.
Oh, right.
I'm not that ambitious, and I wonder why.
Is that true?
Yes.
I think you lack goals, but you're certainly ambitious in the sense that you get up in the morning and you fucking go.
Well,
you
yes.
get shit done.
Because I want to, my ambition comes from realizing my potential. Like this next hour I shoot, I want to surprise myself. I want it to be, I'm onto something here. I know it's going to be really good. And what I'm faced with, you know, you write things that are really funny, that people love, and you got to throw them away because they don't fit in with the context of what I'm trying to say.
Right, we were talking about that earlier. It's really the bits have to grow out of the point of view and the reality
yeah.
of your life.
At least we've reached that point. At least I've built acumen at something. At right. least I know I'm really good at something.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe I'm really good at comedy, believe it or not.
Right.
That's a nice place to be. I have a lot more work to do. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to say when I'm 70 that I have 6, 7, 8, 1 hours under my belt, maybe. That's my
my
diary.
You're also like a phenomenal auditioner. I know when I go, and you're a good actor as well, but
I know when
I go in auditions and I see your name ahead of mine, I just scratch my name
out. You know, Elon Gold said the same thing.
I say, do you validate Park and Callens in there? Because not only do I hear the laughs inside the room, you come out, oh, the casting director's got her arm around you. You got your phones out, figuring out when you're having lunch. I'm like, fuck this.
But that doesn't mean it. Unfortunately, it doesn't mean a goddamn thing because I spend a lot more time out of work than in work.
Yeah, know? But that's par for the course.
Yeah.
I got a buddy who just didn't work. I mean, you go to his IMDb page and just keep fucking scrolling because he's a character actor.
Yeah.
And then he had a year and a half with zero.
I know.
And he lost his health coverage and he was like, he thought it was over. He's ready to move. And then boom, he just landed a series.
God, I know. It's so worrying.
And then you get paid for that series, you know, $25,000 an episode. And all of a sudden it's like, well, that makes up for the year and a half I didn't work.
It does. But, you know, listen, the one thing about stand-up is I think it's made me less successful as an actor because I can always rely on it.
Right.
And I like it more.
Mm-hmm.
I just like it more.
Yeah.
I really love doing it. I can't believe I get to do it for a living.
Right.
Right? I mean, I've done big movies. I mean, I just did Ride Along. It's great and it's fun, but nothing compares to getting up on stage and
right.
for an hour. Nothing that you wrote. yeah. and people are laughing, really?
Mm. And you know can grow. That's the thing that keeps me in it, is doing a bit that works and going, oh, I'm just tapping into it. There's way more inside of this thing.
Well, it's like a song, right? It's like I talked to somebody, a musician about that, Fiona Apple, who was like, sometimes it'll take me 5 years to write a song, sometimes 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But or Springsteen, I actually talked to Springsteen, not to drive.
You did?
I did for an hour and a half.
Shut the fuck on your podcast?
No, just on backstage. Just
no
me and him.
Shit.
And I said, how do you write a song? And he goes, you know, you start with a metaphor and then just kind of wait and something happens or it doesn't.
Yeah.
I was like, I think jokes are the same way.
Right. Right.
I think comedy's. Well, I wasn't going to talk to him about stand up that much.
Did you see the documentary about the making of
yes.
Darkness on the Edge
Had
of Town?
A big influence on me.
I mean, he spent 2 years straight holed up, and Born to Run flew out.
Right. But not only that, you know, actually, Born to Run took 9 months. People don't realize. But not only that, but Born to Run was such a huge hit. And he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek back in the day when that was where that was like the biggest thing.
Oh,
yeah. And he goes, you know what? I am going to. He was throwing away hits because they didn't. And Darkness on the Edge of Town, which is one of my favorite albums of all time, right. is a moody album. I don't know how well it did commercially. There was a lot of pressure to come out with a bunch of hits.
Yep.
And he was like, nah, it's not.
I'm going
not how
Old
I'm
Testament
feeling.
On this one.
God.
Dark.
And we're talking about it now.
Right.
And that's had a huge influence
I think it's
on
my
me.
Favorite spring. It's hard me to too. Not say Born to Run just because, like, Thunder Road and Jungle Land.
She's the one. Jungle Land, my God.
I mean, Jungle Land, I
Meeting
still
Across
get,
the River?
Right.
Come on.
Oh.
What?
That just floats through the
but
air.
But how about Darkness? How about Something in the Night from Darkness on the Edge of Town or Darkness on the Edge of Town, the song? I mean,
or Adam Raised a Cane.
Forget it. The guy yeah. was on another level.
Right. And, yeah, but I guess the point is, you know, for a guy like that, he's a perfectionist, and he doesn't give a fuck what people like. When I watched that
but
documentary, I was like, the E Street Band must be so pissed at him right now because they're sitting around for days. They say just to find the first snare drum beat on I forget which song it is. He spent like a week
yeah.
getting this, yeah. and it was just like, I'd be like, Bruce, what the fuck, you
know? I know.
And you realize
But
like,
when you see a giant like that and you realize how much effort it took him, you realize there are no giants. There's just effort.
Right.
And more importantly, when you say a perfectionist, what I would suggest is it's not even a perfectionist. I would suggest it is this need to really follow the tempo and the metric of his inner compass.
Right.
There is only one path, and that is, and there's only one guide, and that is what really feels right, what is really the truth artistically.
And that can change.
Yes.
You know, between those two albums, something else was going on inside of him.
Exactly. And it's why at 62, and I went and saw his concert, he's still killing it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, who's doing that? The fucking Stones? The cover band of themselves? Huh? No, they're not. Nobody's done that.
Mm.
Nobody's done that.
And he's coming back around, isn't he? Springsteen?
Yeah.
Is he coming this summer?
Yeah, I think. Well, he's always touring.
Let's work on some tickets for that.
I'll get us.
I got a
hookup.
You got a guy?
I got a real hookup.
Dude, get the tickets.
I got us backstage.
By the way, guess where I'm going to a Lakers? And granted, it's the Lakers. They're out of the playoffs. Guess where I'm sitting at the game on Sunday?
You sitting courtside?
Courtside next to the bench. There's eight seats between the scoring table and the bench.
Yeah.
Ari Emanuel's got four of them. And then Norm Pattis has the other four.
You know, Ari, I've heard Ari Emanuel can dunk a basketball.
Is that true?
He's an actual athlete. Which bothers me because he's that successful,
right?
Anyway, I don't know him, so.
But I'm in the Norm Pattis seats, and you know, I just started doing my podcast over Podcast One, and he said he'd bring me to a Lakers game, and I was like, that's never gonna fucking happen. I get an email yesterday, and so I was like, I wonder how good the seats are, because I said to myself, he goes, bring me, and then it said pair of tickets. So I emailed his assistant. I go, you mean I get two tickets? So I said to my son, I go, you want to go to a fucking, and he's 13, you want to go to a Lakers game courtside? And then I was like, oh God, is that not the move? Like, I don't know if that's courtside, if I'm supposed to, maybe I'm supposed to go bring a celebrity with me or
yeah.
something, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think the call is on that? Was that wrong to bring my 13-year-old son?
You take your son.
That's what I did. And so then I go online and I Google Norm Pattis and Lakers seats, and it comes up, the literally said the best seats at the Staples Center for the Lakers.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I said to my son, when I first got I go, they're courtside. And then later I go, well, you know, they probably like in the third row or whatever. He goes, you said they were courtside. And I'm like, go fuck yourself. Who are you?
You see what happens?
Right.
You see what happens? But you were courtside.
They are courtside. Feet.
And you've done it yet?
No, we're going on Sunday.
Oh, man.
And I am so overwhelmed. I feel, and meanwhile, I had told him I'm a big Lakers fan. So, which I like the Lakers, but I don't know shit. So I've been, there's this series on whatever the channel the Lakers cover.
Yeah.
The 24 hours, there's documentaries about the Lakers and news shows.
Right.
And I'm just immersing myself so that I know what the fuck I'm talking about.
If you could be a professional athlete at one sport, what would it be?
Hockey.
Really?
No doubt.
Why?
Because it's fluid. It's not like a... I played hockey my whole life.
Oh, you did?
And I just feel like it's the ultimate team sport. You have respect for the other team. It's a ballet that's going on out there.
Yeah, I've never seen a hockey game before.
Really?
No, never been to a hockey game. I hear it's amazing.
It's amazing, and you know, you don't get injuries like you do in other sports. I mean,
I hung with the Blackhawks in
Chicago.
Dave Bolin and some of his buddies.
That's
animals.
The team, man.
Animals. Studs.
They are, but they're polite.
Yeah, great guy. Well, the Canadian, a lot of them, and they're just, you wouldn't want to fight them. They're all.
You don't want to fight them, but they're not that big. You know, most of these guys are like, 5'10 to 6'1. They're not huge.
Thick, though. I mean, some of those
they're
guys
thick,
are, yeah.
But you know what it is you think about a basketball player, no equipment, no expense, hanging out on a street corner, you're playing on a fucking blacktop, fighting for your team to get. Hockey, you got a dad that's taking you to the ice at 11 midnight and buying you equipment and have to sit in a cold rink and wait for you and take you home. You come from a decent family if you're playing hockey.
Yeah, you're right.
There's no single moms.
You're right. That's a very good point. That's a very interesting point. Yeah. It seems like it'd be a really fun thing to do.
It's amazingly fun because I chipped a bone in my neck when I was in high school because I'm small, but I played defense. So wow. I used to. The coach taught me how to check
chipped
guys with
a bone in your neck.
Yeah, the C6 has got a little chip.
The
corner.
How the hell did that happen?
I would head check people. He taught me how to head check people because I was too small to use my shoulder or my hips on guys. And I just jammed it and something chipped.
Oh.
It was floating around in there. Yeah. And so, you know, but other than that, I never, you know, you don't twist ankles. You don't break stuff. Yeah. It obviously happens.
I would think you did, but you don't.
Not with the frequency that basketball gets. I mean, football, it's nothing like
that. Well, somebody said, football player said, you know, the two things, the two parts of your body that are not made for rough sports are your knees and your head.
Yeah.
Those are not made for sports.
Right.
Human beings are not made for that.
Do you think football is going to fundamentally change and become less popular?
It has become less popular with me.
Yeah.
As I've learned what that kind of head trauma does to people later on, don't watch it with the same gusto.
When there's a head tackle, I literally recoil.
Maybe that's because we're getting older and we have children.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I don't. It just has soured me to the game. Right. It's funny you say this because I literally I had the NFL package. I mean, I would, I'd watch Sunday, forget it. I was there. And
what's your
team,
the Pats?
Probably the Giants. But I.
Wait,
but,
where'd you grow up?
Well, I'm from New York, but I grew up all over the world.
Yeah.
But I this season I watched the Super Bowl. That was it. Well, I watched a couple of playoff
picked
games.
The wrong game, my friend.
Yeah, I know.
Mm.
So weird. But, you know, for the most part, that's I just don't like seeing guys get all messed up.
But that's the other thing about, like, you're into mixed martial arts is, like, those guys don't get injured as much
not
as you
nearly.
Would think they
no.
do.
Well, no, because you're not wearing big gloves, so you get knocked out really quickly. Plus, it's wrestling, and these guys are really tough. And, you know, you're trying to – it's one-on-one. You're not getting blindsided.
Right.
You can get knocked out. I mean, now the problem with with MMA is that they're training with boxers. And so their sparring gives you a headache. You're sparring, you're taking shots to the head.
Right.
And as these guys are learning how to sit down in their punches, they're learning how to really punch. They're so powerful.
Yeah.
That it used to be wrestlers who were punching and they were just kind of tight in their shoulders and stuff. And they were tough, but it wasn't.
So it's becoming more striking and less wrestling.
Yeah, now these guys, now you're getting high level kicker punchers. And man,
the other thing is, you know, those leg kicks, man, that's got to do a number on your.
hamstrings. It does, but I've talked to a lot of guys who, you know, you learn how to check those kicks. A lot of that's muscle damage. When you start getting hit in the jaw and the head,
yeah,
and your brain's getting rattled, that's a very different situation.
Right.
When you lose the vision in your eye, or, you know, that's a problem.
Right.
I don't like that. When George St. Pierre is talking about memory loss,
yeah,
then we have to talk.
Right. Right.
You know, time.
What is an adjustment they could make to MMA that would
bigger gloves?
Right.
But even then.
But there's something about, like, they say there's less injuries in rugby than football because they're not wearing helmets.
That's true.
That there's almost a respect for, well, first of all, you got a shoulder tackle instead of head tackle.
I'll tell you what, though. I was in Biarritz, which is the south of France on the border of Spain in the Basque region. And I went to a rugby game between the Basques and the French. First of all, there are a lot of Samoans and Maoris on those teams. And then just big, big, powerful men from
big, you know, heads.
They're the men I want to be. Like, if you want to talk about my heartbreak, it's the fact that I wasn't born into that body.
Right.
Like, to be a big, powerful, intimidating rugby player.
Yeah.
Where you walk in and people go, look at the shoulders. What do you lift? And it's like, nah, I was just born this way. It's got big joints. Maybe the coolest looking people in the world are Maori or Samoan rugby players.
Yeah.
They're the athletic version of Samoans.
Right.
They're the mesomorphs of they're just like the muscular version. And but they were, that was as rough as it gets.
I mean, the French are known. My brother-in-law played rugby his whole life, and he played in for Wisconsin. And then he went over to South Africa, where he lives now, and he played there. He went to a tournament in France, and he said it was like nothing he'd ever played. They are the dirtiest motherfuckers.
Oh, man. You're dealing with rugby players. They're lifting and juicing, and it's become a different game.
Right.
It's more speed. The training is, you know, it's a very different game.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I lived with rugby players in college, and I used to go watch them play. And I mean, they just were tough. They'd sleep, you know, we go out drinking, they'd sleep 4 hours, get up, throw up, and then they would jog to the field, stay on. My one roommate was the captain or the president. He'd stay out there the whole fucking game in the rain. Then they'd go drink.
Yeah.
And wrestle. I remember we had a party at our apartment one time, and they started wrestling, and they fucking flattened the kitchen table and just laughed.
Yeah, well. They're big, powerful guys, but one thing that I'll tell you is my buddies who play D1 football, if you start talking to them about rugby, they might just start punching you. They'll just be like, yeah, guess what rugby players are? Guys that didn't make the football team.
That's true. That is true.
I mean, so let's all take a step back because, you know, you're not going to impress. My buddy tried to fight an entire rugby. I wasn't there, but he played I can say his name, Gavin O'Connor, who's now a big director, directed Warrior and stuff. But my buddy Jimmy Burke told me that he was with Gavin. Gavin was 21 or 20 and just, you know, 225 and 6'3".
Football
just,
player?
Yeah, hell of an athlete. Like, he was he was all Ivy at UPenn, middle linebacker. And I think tried out for the Jets, but basically tried to fight the entire rugby team.
No shit.
On the cruise. He was like, the fuck you guys looking at? Like, literally.
Wow.
He's like, he was football, and he's not hearing a peep out of an entire team.
Right.
Yeah, so I'd like to be that guy. Again, I'm not doing any of that.
Well, you know, look, we need bouncers. It's important that we have football players because, you know, there's bars that need people thrown out of. I mean, that's the thing about football is you really narrow your options when you're going to play. But I think any college-level sport, it's nice that you've got that drive and that you're achieving. But, you know, less than 1% of you are going to make a living at this.
Less than 1%.
Right.
Isn't that crazy?
And the rest of you are getting injuries that will haunt you for the rest of your life.
You're not
doing as well in school. You're socializing with other rockheads.
Yeah, by the way, the D1 programs, you know, in Nebraska and these places, the academics are so abysmal. You got these kids. First of all, the school makes a fortune on these kids. Mm-hmm. The kids get paid nothing. And it's a huge business. And you as a student are paying for the football. You're paying a premium for their football.
Right.
For the football team and the stadium and everything else. And so it's a professional sport. The kids are not getting an education. I know a lot of football players who, I mean, it's appalling.
It's appalling. First of all, if you're a business major on the football team, you should fail immediately because you're looking at the business model of 80,000 people. I just met this guy who played on Florida State when they won in 2000, I guess. And he's, you know, he's like, if I could take those years back, he goes, I got a ring out of it.
A ring.
You know, and I got injuries, and he goes, and I didn't get the education that I should have gotten. Yeah. And, you know.
Thanks a lot, University of Florida and Florida State. Thanks
right,
a lot.
Right. And 85,000 people piling in. He goes, the average ticket price was $100. That's $8.5 million.
And guess who's seeing it? None of the players.
Right. And I said, why don't they have a recipe like you play, you know, you play a season, you get 10 grand banked, you get that in a trust fund when you graduate. And so you accrue money. At least when you get out, you got something to show for
I think
it.
That's fair. How about more than 10 grand?
Right.
How about 100 grand?
How about 100 grand a year?
Why is that so hard?
Yeah.
Well, they can afford it.
I mean, in the pros, a major player is making how much do you make?
You're set. You get a pension and everything. I just think it's outrageous that these kids are not getting educations, and they are basically entertainment.
I heard some motion was just made to form a union that made it. I heard it very vaguely, but that the
I don't know
college
much about
players
it.
Are forming a union.
Yeah, my buddy Sam Sheridan read a book called he's an author, and he read a book called I think The Greatest Game or something.
Oh,
like
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah,
I've got
the exposing sort of the college program.
Oh, The Greatest Game. No, I've got a book called The Greatest Game Ever Played.
Yeah, that's what it is. I think.
Okay, I haven't read it. It's sitting on my nightstand.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I can't read it because I forgot how. I can only listen to books.
Well,
now.
Who has time?
Isn't it the greatest though? If I'm stuck in traffic, and by the way, keep an eye on time. I don't want you running late. You got a big meeting.
We got about 3 minutes left.
Okay,
was this a short but sweet podcast?
It was unbelievable. We covered philosophy. We covered war, sports.
Yeah,
we didn't talk about sex, but that's kind of a victory, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, sex is, you know, sex. Sex
good way to close out a set.
Yeah.
You know?
Sex isn't as important to me anymore. It is.
Well, anymore. I mean, that's the amazing thing is that it's still in there the way a castrated dog will still hump your leg.
Yeah.
Like, if you called me on it, I could not pull off a three-way.
I know.
It's all I want, but do I really want it? Or is it like a hunger pang
Well, the things you used to do to get it, the amount of work I put into getting laid, the nights I would stay up talking to a girl I didn't even like as a person, whatever it was, you know. Just
well, you were an
things.
All-star, yeah.
Yeah, I put up some numbers.
You put up some numbers.
I'm not proud of it. It's like that ring. All I got out of it was a ring, right?
Right.
I wasted a lot of time.
All you got out of it.
Yeah, well, that's true. I was lucky.
I had crabs once. I got
had chlamydia. Don't
chlamydia.
Kid yourself.
I got chlamydia. Did
I got,
you get the
no,
Schwab?
No, I had gonorrhea, and I knew I shouldn't have slept with this girl. It was in Florida.
Women don't know they're carrying it, right?
Well, I don't know. I just had a feeling. I was like, I should wear a condom.
Yeah.
And I was young and nuts. But for the amount of behavior, for the amount of appalling, you know, just nights, I really skated through. But I was talking to a guy you know, and I won't mention his name, but he's a comic. And I said, have you ever, I go, he just loves his naughty girls. And I go, you rapping that thing? And he goes, fuck no. And I said, you ever get any? And he goes, no, I've never had a, I'm immune to that shit. I mean, I've had a drip, but. And I went, well, back up there. Back this up. A trip is called gonorrhea, you fucking idiot. What are you talking about?
Well, you know what's crazy is my son's 13 and he just did a paper for school. They had to pick an issue.
Yeah.
AIDS. Him and his friend did a paper on AIDS.
Yeah.
Which I was proud of him. I mean, that's a real fucking issue to grapple with. And he was writing about, you know, the autoimmune aspect of it and how they develop drugs.
Yeah.
And then he goes, and he knew that homosexuals got it. And he goes, why do homosexuals get HIV more than other people? And it's just like, I got a call. I got to grab this call real quick.
I can tell you, it depends. The reason gay men got disproportionately and straight men basically didn't get it in this country, but yet it's a heterosexual disease in Africa. They figured this out. The gay men that were actually receiving, you know, were taking it.
Right.
When you push into the body and there are tears in that area, you absorb things. So the semen carry the virus.
Right, I knew that. I didn't want to tell him that.
When you're actually,
how do you say that to your son?
I don't know. When the men that were actually doing the fucking, they survived the epidemic.
Right.
in Africa, the reason that you and I, as you know, for at least for me, I was exposed to, you know, having sex a lot. It never really made its way into the white European population, because you are a descendant of people that survived the Black Plague, and you have a genetic mutation that makes you HIV resistant, and you have to get it. The people that died who were straight were people that shot it into their veins with intravenous drugs, or were.
Is this a confirmed thing, or is this like blood transfusions?
No.
No, in I'm fact, talking about the go fact to TED. that Europeans
go to TED.com. Juan Enriquez talks
no
about
shit.
It, who is a venture capitalist and a futurist and is actually a scientist and invests in scientific technologies, and he was talking about it. And they have isolated a genetic mutation that you had to have to survive the bubonic plague. Remember, the bubonic plague in certain parts of Europe killed a third to
one
a half
out of three people.
Yeah, I mean, even a half in certain villages, or wiped out entire villages. The people that survived were those people that had that genetic mutation. Geneticists always talk about a portion of a population will always survive a virus because they have a built-in mutation or they develop a mutation.
Right.
So it's an evolutionary thing.
It's also about with poor people, poor nutrition, that their tissue is more likely to tear.
That's probably not true. That was another theory. But in fact, in Africa and in East Asia, they had their own diseases, but they didn't have to deal with the bubonic plague. And so people of African descent don't have that genetic mutation. So in Africa, it was widespread. It was you were able to catch it just through, you know, vaginal, you know, contact if you were a man.
Wow.
And they kept figuring out. They were looking at the army, and there was just no AIDS, HIV cases, very few. They couldn't figure it out.
Because there's no gay people in the army.
Well, you know, that's what they say. Don't ask, don't tell. Anyway, I'm glad we solved that problem. It is not a conspiracy theory. There is a scientific reason for that. I hope you learned everything. This has been Greg Fitzsimmons.
Solid way to land a podcast.
Yeah. Where are you going to be? Stand up wise.
I'm going to be performing, God, where am I? Fort Lauderdale, somewhere in Texas, somewhere in the Northeast. If you go to FitzDog.com, there's some tour dates. I'm very busy this spring, so come out and see me.
I'll be in Vancouver April 3rd, 4th, 5th. So come by. I can't wait. Thanks for listening, everybody. Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.